Hey, everybody, it's Connor. Again, if you're listening to this, it is an off week for us for one reason or another. Maybe we ran out of episodes to give you and we took too many weeks off because we're just rascals like that. But I'm going to give you a little something new. I'm not just reissuing an old episode. I'm going to actually harmonize on it a little bit. So back in, when did we do this? In January of 2023, we talked about Avatar: The Way of Water. And when I say we, I mean Kellen and Dustin talked about it because they saw it. I did not. I knew a lot about it. I knew a lot about the production. And so we talked about the film. I told them spoilers were fine. I don't think they ended up actually spoiling anything. And so that was that. And we put that out. But I have now seen the film. And I had enough thoughts on it that differed from their review that I wanted to record my own. And this is why you don't just blindly listen to your friends all the time, because I had a very different experience than the two of them had. So I wanted to issue this episode, which will just be the original conversation of the three of us talking about the movie. And then I cut a lot of the back half of it out, which was mostly just about whether or not to see it in theaters, which obviously is a recommendation that does not apply if you're listening to this episode because it's not in theaters anymore. And a fair amount of discussion about long movies in general, which I didn't think applied to this movie. So I cut out the review parts and left that in. And then after they are finished talking, I will come back on with my fresh thoughts now having seen the film for the back half. So if you're a little confused, just look at the time code. It'll be fine. So enjoy the episode. I'll see you in a bit. Let's talk about Avatar: The Way of Water.
Dad, I know you think I'm crazy. But I feel her. I hear her heartbeat. She's so close.
What does her heartbeat sound like?
Mighty.
Cannot let you bring your war here.
Outcast. That's all they see.
I see you.
The way of water connects all things. Before your birth and after your death.
This is our home!
I need you with me, and I need you to be strong. Strong heart.
All right, so this is obviously the sequel to Avatar, the 2009 film by James Cameron. This one, once again, written, directed by James Cameron. Screenplay by James Cameron. And then I didn't know this. Rick Jaffa and Amanda Silver, who, I don't know if you know who those people are. They're the ones who like kind of re-kicked off the apes, the Planet of the Apes movies, like the Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I think they wrote the first one. I think they have story by on the other two because of all the, the character creation and whatnot.
Yeah.
Anyway, they're solid. So Maybe. I don't know. I haven't seen this. You two saw this. So I don't have anything to say about it, really. So I'm going
to
wait.
For do you want us to keep it spoiler free?
No. It's cool. It's cool. I mean, unless it's the best twist of all time.
No, it's such a flimsy plot that you can explain the plot in two sentences.
Yeah.
Actually, that's a challenge. So? Dustin, do a synopsis in two sentences.
Oh, don't put me on the spot like that.
I mean, I'll try after you.
Okay. Stephen Lang has returned to Pandora and chases Jake Sully and his family to a new tribe in the Water Tribe lands.
That's one
and
sentence. Oh, it's a run-on sentence. Here we go.
Oh, it's a run-on sentence. Okay, no, period. Period right there. Next sentence. While there, comma. Jake Sully and his family must navigate new friends.
Ah, navigate.
New loves. And learning the way of whale, the way of water, in Avatar, the way of water,
the way of whale,
the way of whales.
No. They're tokuns, not whales. Dustin.
Tokuns, the way of Tokun. J.R.R. Tolkien brings you. anyway, I don't know. So they go to the Water Tribe land, and then they have to figure out how to live there away from Stephen Lang. But then that dude comes back, man, and he finds them there, and now they got to fight.
Gotcha. How long has it been between
13 years?
Okay. Plot.
In the film?
Yeah.
Within the story?
I think they're probably doing like 16-ish.
Yeah, their kids are teenagers. So
right. Like the oldest brother, he's the oldest one, right, Dustin?
Yeah, yeah.
He seems like 17-ish or something.
Yeah, but, something like but that.
This is the Na'vi. I don't know how their physiology works and biology works. So.
It says here 14 years on Wikipedia.
Okay, then they age a little faster because ain't no way that older brother was 14. As far as human years go, but flesh out what Dustin was saying, instead of finding a new villain or a new conflict that they need to overcome, Stephen Lang's character—I don't even remember the name of him—the brash, cartoonishly evil military guy from the first movie wakes up in the body of what do they call them? Navitar. He wakes up in a Navitar body with a screen of Stephen Lang telling him, like, I bet you're wondering how you got here. It means I'm dead, and now you are the real me because that's all that's left, and it was on a hard drive.
I've implanted all my memories before the climactic battle in the first film
that your death because that wasn't on the backup.
So go back to the first film. Right before that fight happens, he puts all his memories in a Na'vi body.
In case I die, I want all my spite and hatred saved on a hard drive in case I die and I need that mission continued.
I'm a horrible racist.
Yeah.
I'm a horrible racist, but I would love for all of my memories to go into the type of person I hate.
So I'm doing really bad at filling out the synopsis and not just shitting on the movie already.
Do you remember in the last Star Wars movie when it says somehow Emperor Palpatine returns? Yeah. Same thing.
Yeah. So really, like, picture me being like, all right, buckle in. It's going to be 3 hours. You really love 3-hour movies. Oh, you really love putting 3D glasses on. All right. One of the first scenes that sets up the story is we couldn't come up with a better antagonist, so we're just doing it again, and he's blue now. And that's really it. Like, nothing that the Na'vi achieved in the prior film stopped the onslaught of Americans.
Sky dwellers, I think they call them.
Yeah. Sky people coming to the planet. So, like,
Skywalkers.
There was no victory in the prior film, and they are getting pursued, and so to save the rest of the tree Na'vi people, Jake Sully and his family of his wife, two sons. Sigourney Weaver's Navitar had a Immaculate Conception baby for whatever reason that isn't explained. And then their daughter, they all leave and go to this other tribe that is like literally a different race of Navi. They look different. They've got like webbed fingers and all this stuff, and they're water based and they live and there. They live there Gen until Z. They're what?
They're a little more Gen Z.
Oh yeah. It's a kid movie. It's a movie about a bunch of kids, just so you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they track them there and they have a, like a big, you know, climactic fight. There's no, there's nothing there. And that's my big criticism is that I saw a lot of really pretty shit. And I think that's the point of the movie. And I get that that's probably the point of the movie, but I don't know. It just felt real dead. And I feel so bad because of all the creative talent that had to go into making the movie look as good as it did. It's just not for me. And that's my review. I'd give it a 3.5 purely on a completely like technical and visual impressive standpoint.
Yeah.
But a story. Yeah. Nah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I gave this 4 stars, but it's the same thing. It's bolstered by the technical achievement where we talked in our last episode about Smile and how Kellen was talking about seeing, or was it Connor? I don't know who it is. Somebody was talking about, somebody was saying it was Kellen talking about with the therapist that was walking. And then you like, you can just see that shot happening, like how it would happen. There's none of that here for me because I can't tell what was really shot and what wasn't. I'm assuming most of it was.
I think hardly any of it was real.
Yeah. But like the seams are so seamless. It's a really big technical achievement. And I know everyone said that about the first one. I never felt that way. I did not like the first movie. I've only ever seen it the one time in theaters.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just didn't care for it. It was like, this isn't for me. This one I liked a little more, but it's not because of the story. It's because of the technical achievement of it. The story has some pretty big issues. I felt like Jake Sully was not the protagonist of the film. It's like his son's story. But that wasn't as fleshed out as it should have been if that was going to be the crux of it. And structurally wise, like if you're talking about the structure of the screenplay, it takes too long to get to him, to focus on him, to really allow you to latch on to him. And then everything that happens is incredibly predictable to the point where it kind of loses its value.
I was not surprised at anything in the film.
Yeah, I heard somebody say this is like the most expensive CW show ever made because a huge part of it is just like him being like, hey, I like that girl and I like that whale. I'm gonna go chill with that whale and talk about that girl.
And his dad's like, don't chill with that whale.
Yeah. And he's like, it's a Tolkien dad.
You don't understand me, Dad.
Yeah. And Zoe Saldana's there, like, but she does nothing. Maybe my biggest complaint about the story is things happen, but very rarely do they have a reason to happen. So Stephen Lang is back. Why? He just is, right?
Yeah.
There's hardly a reason for it. They go to the water people. Why? Because this movie's about water.
It's a James Cameron film.
Well, and they didn't they develop like an underwater mocap? Basically how can we push our filmmaking technology? How do we wrap a story around that?
Yeah. Yes, correct.
Yeah, I'll talk and about then, that. And in it's a like,
and it's James Cameron being, it literally plays a little bit like a James Cameron greatest hits because there's just enough of like Aliens T2 in here to like make you feel like, oh, this is James Cameron. And then he's like, oh, but also remember Titanic. And there's a lot of Titanic in here. And there's like a capsizing boat with water screaming in. And like, it's like, oh, seen that before. And then it's like, hey, remember Avatar? Well, this is also Avatar. And so it's just like James Cameron being like, hey, remember The Abyss?
Yeah, I was about to say, there's even Abyss stuff going on in it. Yeah.
So it plays like a James Cameron greatest hits record.
Does he have terminal cancer?
No, they just said he's going to write three more freaking movies.
Like, is this literally his last film?
Yeah. Yeah. This is a culmination of my entire career.
Yeah.
It even has Jim, there's three more.
Yeah, sure.
Somebody mentioned that offhandedly, and I was like, I'm so over
the queen lady
voice acting stunt casting. It's so annoying. Just hire someone who specializes in that because she didn't give a bad performance, but it didn't matter that it was Kate Winslet and that money could have, she probably got paid way too much.
I didn't know until afterwards. I was like, I thought Kate Winslet was in that. And somebody's like, oh yeah, she was the lady. And I was like, who? And I had to Google it. And I was like, oh, that lady. Okay. Gotcha. The lady that has like 12 lines. Got it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree. Like, get somebody with some, like, I don't know. It's one of those weird things where it's like, if you're going to use the person, then make it look more like the person, but don't do that because then you're Robert Zemeckis.
So like I watched like the ABC 2020 did like a thing on this. So I watched some of that and I watched a couple other like, you know, behind the scenes things for this. And so I think I've seen the first film like two or three times. Probably it's one of the first Blu-rays I own because it was 2009 and I, you know, James Cameron comes up when I talk about Jon Favreau these days because I've accused Jon Favreau of, and I'm not mad at him, like, you know, most of what he's doing seems to be in the service of pushing forward technology. Like, Jon Favreau has earned his stripes as a storyteller and he certainly deserves whatever success is coming his way. However lazy or unnecessary some of it is, you know, like Lion King or some of the other stuff that, you know, he's involved with, you know, I like Jon Favreau, so I'm not mad at him for taking a blank check from Lucasfilm and being like, okay, cool, I guess I'll just go play for a few years. But I liken it a lot to James Cameron because it's like he is in it and many filmmakers are in it for the technical, you know, directors all have their strengths. And for people like James Cameron and Jon Favreau and some other people, it's really has less to do with story and it has more to do with technology.
Spectacle.
Yeah. And like, just the old school, like film, you know, movie going experience, and a bunch of patents probably that come out of making movies like this, which is, I'm sure a lot of how you convince a studio like Disney and Fox, like to sink this much money into all these projects. It's like, you're going to co-own the patents of a ton of new software that's going to get used for decades. And that's how you forget the box office. They're going to be using this water mocap tech until someone, probably me, invents another one. And then you can own the license on that one too. Like,
as James Cameron. I thought you were saying it as Connor.
Not me. No,
it's probably going to be me.
No.
Probably me. I'm going to make Avatar 3. The Way of Hooper.
No, I didn't even realize Skype could have three-way calls until recently. So it won't be me.
Three-way calls, underwater mocap. It's a logical connection.
Same. Yeah, we'll get there. No. So like, it's one of those things where it's like, to me, everything y'all are saying is meeting my expectations of what the movie is. Like, I'm not expecting a gangbuster story. I just expect that it's going to be a technically beautiful film and that I'm going to be impressed with how it was made and the implications of what comes out of it. Like, like you're saying, like, if you look at the behind the scenes, like, you're right. Like, hardly any of it is real except for like, if they're running on some log, there's like a big green, you know, key green log they're running on in these suits and everything. But like everything else about how these movies are made, like the way they're standing isn't even that important because they could just decide, they're stooping too low. They can change the character's posture. It's the face, it's the performance, and it's really, really good reference.
Yeah.
But one of the things that bumps me on stuff like this is like, they're showing a side by side of like, you know, Zoe Saldana and Neytiri. And I see the performance and I can see that it's coming from this take, but I'm still like, I don't like that some of her performance is being lost from the transfer of the human footage to the Na'vi stuff. Yeah. And part of it was like, is it the technology? Is it that the technology is not good enough? Because, and it's like, no, it's not the technology. It's the character design. If you look at Josh Brolin and Thanos, like Thanos is humanoid. Like he has a chin, he has a nose, his eyes, like he has a pretty much a human anatomy. Yeah. So things that Josh Brolin is doing, lots of subtleties can make it into that performance. But when you like, when you character map, I'm sure you guys know about this to an extent. Like when you care, when you design a character, like, especially when they're shaped, when they have faces like the Na'vi, it's different. The muscles aren't going to be in the same place as they are in people. So a subtle affectation from Zoe Saldana as a person can't transfer to Neytiri because they don't have the same muscle structure. But then you go, all right, what's more important? Like being true to like the anatomy of this character or like trying to get some emotion out of this actor, you know, into this performance. Yeah. If you really want to impress me with the technology.
Yeah.
I watched James Cameron's Masterclass recently and I watched a ton of behind the scenes on all of this. So I'm very impressed with him as a filmmaker, just, you know, for all the obvious reasons, everything that he's done and everything he was able to do in the earlier part of his career. And of course, all the way through all of these films, like he's certainly like one of the greats, like, but he's, to me, it seems like he's in that part of his life where he's like, he secured a gigantic deal with a gigantic company wherein he can spend the twilight of his career, you know, playing with toys and making them cooler and better. And, you know, the film that he's expected to make from all that playtime doesn't have to be even that good. It just has to be, it's just a proof of concept that Disney can monetize.
Yeah.
And, you know, and as far as what this film has made, I mean, this says 1.7 billion. I'm guessing that's worldwide. I don't know if that's a good enough or not. I mean, I know
it broke profitability like finally, last week or something.
I know that it was like a disappointment when it first came out, or they're lower than expected or something like that. But as Dustin,
but it's going to have a long tail to it for sure.
It's got a long tail. We were talking, Dustin, how like these days, like you don't even, it's all about the verticals, like whatever this movie makes. Again, my software theory and patent theory aside, toys, parks, you know, the other films that it builds momentum for. Like, I mean, let's not forget, this is like a 13-year-old sequel, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, like,
parks will be a big thing. If Disney can see an uptick in merch sales at the parks and like ticket sales at the gate, then of Animal Kingdom, then they'll justify the film like getting a sequel.
Yeah. And I also think that this, like having like what, three more sequels coming.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so this is the first of what's going to be not giant gaps between films anymore. I mean, this was supposed to come out last year. They delayed it because of COVID. So like, you know, it's not like there's going to be 13 years between every film and we're going to walk into them equally unenthused, you know, like the next film's going to be out like in 2 years or 1 year or something. It's like,
I think Sam Worthington said they're like 80% through filming the next one. So presumably there's still a year or two of VFX.
Oh geez. I thought they'd shot them all already.
No.
I know that they can shoot them quickly. They say one of the things this enables is that you can shoot them very fast because there's just, you eliminate all the time that's killed by multiple setups.
I think I did read that James Cameron shot out the kids for the series so that they wouldn't age out, because I think he specifically mentioned like the Stranger Things problem, which was the kids outgrew the roles and the show had to change.
Yeah.
So with that, he wanted to avoid that. And I'm like, why? Sigourney Weaver's playing a 14-year-old in this movie.
Exactly.
Yeah. Who cares? Need to do that.
I do recommend Avatar: The Way of Water, if only for what it gives you visually and audibly. I don't necessarily recommend it for its groundbreaking story.
Kellen, you said something earlier about what happened to the 90-minute movie.
Yeah, go.
So you were talking about seeing James Cameron interviews and stuff or something on 2020, whatever.
Yeah.
I saw some clip where he was like, he was talking about the first Avatar. I think he was like, we were nearing, you know, the end of production. And when we gave a screening or whatever, there was a note from the studio about like, you know, why is this scene of flight or something going on so long? We've finished the purpose of what this sequence was for, what this scene was for, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, yeah. Right. And he's like, and good for you for ticking all the executive boxes or whatever. And he's like, the reason why it's this long is that I want it to be this long. I want to see this. And therefore, because, you know, I'm the filmmaker and I'm trusted to, you know, blah, 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 blah. Other people might want to, you know, see this as well, kind of thing. And I was like, I get that. I have made executive decisions because it's what I would like to see done in a production. But like, I think there is a lot of kowtowing to that notion these days. And like, I think it's pretty shitty to say that it's like, oh, you're being a good, you know, ticking all the boxes and being a good film critic by saying everything has to be, you know, this thing, this thing, this thing. That's what makes a good film, kind of thing. I think that's like defensive behavior, because films of this type, like with as little to say as it has, do not need to be 3 hours. I'm coming off of like a couple years of just really good bones of films, even more than bones, just going, staying way beyond their welcome. Like the Matt Reeves Batman movie, fantastic Batman movie, encapsulated. Holy shit, that needed to be 45 minutes shorter. So watching Avatar, there were a lot of sequences, you know, swimming with the Tulkoons, doing all this other stuff where I'm like, you know, James, it didn't need to be this long. And it's not because I'm a fucking loser and you're the amazing auteur. It's too long. It overstays it. Well, it's welcome. You're in a fucking, like, I don't know. I'm just so grumpy about how I have to look at runtimes of films before I determine whether I'm going to go see them these days. Runtimes of films have gotten to a point where I look at that rather than reviews, or at least in addition to reviews. And if it is over 2.5 hours, I just go, do I really care to see this enough?
Yeah.
So that's my old man rant.
Point taken. I think after the Lord of the Rings, which I realized was a while ago, there came a time, Lord of the Rings won a million Oscars and everyone loved it. And it's well received. And to this day, it's a classic. Right. And I think what happened in the wake of that was there became this notion that in order for your film to be some sort of prestige film, especially in terms of blockbusters, it has to be over 2 hours, because you're looking at it like, okay, well, this is just a dumb superhero movie. Okay, we'll make it 3 hours, and then suddenly it's art.
It's epic.
It's
profound.
And I don't think that that's true. Here's looking at you, Zack Snyder's Justice League.
Right.
I don't think that there's any reason for these movies to be as long as they are. Only very rarely is there enough story to justify that. I do think that there's, you know, enough story for Lord of the Rings, but not every film is the Lord of the Rings, right? So I agree with you. Like this movie could lose 45 minutes pretty easy.
So we'll stop them there, because that's about it. So the last criticism they have about the film is its length. So we'll get into all that. I took a bunch of notes when I saw the movie. So Avatar, I'll back up. So Avatar, The Way of Water, we already talked about all the technical stuff on the front end, James Cameron, all that stuff. So I saw this on Disney Plus, and because of Kellen and Dustin's thoughts on this movie in this review, I was like, oh, I'll probably won't watch this then, because I knew I wasn't going to get to see it in theaters. And again, we recorded and released this episode in January, so I knew I wasn't going to get out to see it in theaters. And so I knew I'd be watching it on Disney Plus anyways. But when it, I just didn't feel a sense of urgency to. And then after hearing them talk about it, I was like, okay, maybe I don't need to see it at all. And I let it go for a while. And then I saw a few YouTube reactors that I follow had all eventually watched and made videos about The Way of Water. And it was mostly just how emotional it was, how crying thumbnails. I was like, oh, okay. So I sort of tucked those away. And then after a while, Cinema Therapy did an episode about like family dynamics or something, and they used The Way of Water as their thing. And so enough influencers and YouTubers that I follow were using it as either reaction fodder or case studies on family dynamics, to where I was like, okay, hold on. Is there more here than I'm realizing there is? And so I was like, okay, I want to watch the movie now. So I watched the movie on Disney Plus. And like I said in the intro, this is why you shouldn't always just listen to your friends. We do this podcast and we tell people whether or not we think they should see something, but we give a lot of context and reasoning. And if you've been listening long enough, you know kind of where we tend to lean on things, and you have adjusted your compass for our perspectives. You know whether or not to listen to Dustin when he tells you something is not working story-wise. You know better than to listen to me if you tend to disagree with me, whether or not something is boring, stuff like that. So I tend to listen to Dustin because he is very in sync with me on certain things, but he tends to be a lot more of a purist about character and structure than I am, even though I am very traditional when it comes to those things. I let a lot of things go that he doesn't, and I make a lot of excuses and apologies for movies that I just like, which is fine. It's all subjective, and so that is known about us. And so, yeah, I feel like I'm more sentimental than Kellen is when it comes to the movies we tend to review together, but we sort of share a bullshit detector when it comes to corporate stuff. So there's a lot of similarities, and that's why I love to talk to the two of them and our other friends on the show all the time, is because we have similar views about movies, but we differ enough from each other to where we can have good discussions. And that's why we have this podcast. So there you go. But I listened to them blindly. Not that it's a big deal. I still saw the movie. But there's just a word of caution there, you know? And this is why. So I wrote a bunch of notes while I watched the movie, and I did not expect to write as many notes as I wrote. And by the end of what I wrote, I was like, I disagree with a lot of things they said in their review. I was blown away with this movie. I intensely felt invested in Jake's family. I felt his responsibility, the weight of his responsibility that he felt, I guess both as whatever, Taruk Makto, but principally as a father. I mean, it doesn't help that Jake and I each have 4 children. So there's a direct avatar, if you will, to me and Jake in that sense. But even if he had 6 kids or 2 kids, like, it's the same thing. So, but I felt the weight of his responsibility that he placed on himself for their well-being and their prosperity as a family, but also just their safety and survival. I feel that. And I felt his fear, his urge, you know, to protect and control the fate of his family. And I also felt his wife and Neytiri's urge for him to let her be who she is, also a protector. And I really loved The Way of Water. I thought this movie was emotional as shit. And I did not expect that from a James Cameron film to feel emotions. I expect to feel excitement and some wonder, but mostly just, you know, thrills. thrills, fear, not terror, but fear, you know, anxiousness, anxiety, tension. But I don't frequently feel deep emotion, and I felt it here heavily. I absolutely loved this experience watching this. And again, this wasn't even in a theater or 3D or anything. Like, this is on Disney Plus on my computer. And I loved it. I don't think a second of screen time is wasted in this movie. I know that the guys are complaining of how long it is, and it is long. There was not a spot in the movie where I felt bored. I didn't feel bored. There's peaks and valleys, just like there is in any film. There's scenes where stuff is happening, and there's scenes where less stuff is happening, but there's never stuff not happening. Even just the flying scenes. Like, we talked about how, you know, James Cameron wants those flying scenes in because they're fun and he's the director and that's really his decision. And Kellen is like, that's a lot of just flying though. Like, I get it, but it's boring and we're not doing anything and stuff. And, you know, James Cameron's like, well, everyone who says it's too long is just kind of ticking the good studio executive critic box. Cool. You contributed notes saying it's too long. So I get the recoil to James Cameron's kind of fuck you, I'm the director stance there. But I stand by it because my warning in the original review was you can do that because it is your film, but realize that when you add up those choices, you get a 4-hour film. And I say to my past self, but that's still fine if what you're watching is exciting or beautiful or interesting. And I think that this movie is. So Kellen and Dustin made this movie kind of seem trivial, but I think that there's a lot to love here, you know, and part of it was good because it was sort of fun to describe the plot in overly simplistic ways and to kind of, you know, to shit on it a little bit. But obviously the visuals here are really great. But again, I think there's very real tension throughout, and because there's just so much at stake for Jake, there's just so much that he can lose. Every scene matters and it pulls the Sullys closer or further from danger. And obviously there's moments in this film. I don't want to spoil anything because I want people to see this. There's moments in this film where I was full blown sobbing. Like, not just kind of like a little dusty, a little bit of tears. I was sobbing in my house alone. That is cinema. I reject that the plot is flimsy. I think there's certain things that Kellen and Dustin said that are I would agree with. I don't think they're a big deal. They didn't slow me down, but they're a little strange, you know. Quaritch just being kind of resurrected through an avatar, or the Immaculate Conception of the Sigourney Weaver character. Yeah, that's kind of weird and unexplained and, you know, seemingly just an excuse to continue to work with Sigourney Weaver and for her to, you know, stretch her legs a little bit and play a child for once, as an older woman. But I don't have a problem that Quaritch is the villain again. I don't. It could have been someone else, but I think if we're going to have Quaritch be like the overarching villain of this series, which we might, then so be it. You know, I don't know if that's what they're doing. It could have been someone else, but again, if you're going to do a different villain, it needs to feel different from Quaritch. So if you, I don't know, I won't say that the antagonist is the strong suit of this film because, you know, it is the same guy. I'm not mad about it though, because I'm threatened by Quaritch. He's smart. He's ruthless. He's, hateful. And, he has a little bit more of a soul in this film. I like this Quaritch more than the original Quaritch. Colonel Quaritch in the original film is just the hard ass Marine, you know, and that's all he is. And that's what he is here too. But this Quaritch is a clone. He's not the same as Miles Quaritch. He sort of has a chance to realize that, well, Miles Quaritch's behavior got him killed. And if I'm going to be any kind of survival oriented clone, I'm going to learn from his mistakes. So this Quaritch is smarter. He is a little more humble, I would say. He does not talk as much, and he has things he actually wants and has a heart for, in a way. So I think this Quaritch, don't get me wrong, there's not much there, but there's a lot more here for Stephen Lang to play with than there was in the original film, where he's just the bad guy. In this one, he's the bad guy, but there's just a little more there that I enjoyed. I think Kellen made a note about how nothing the Na'vi achieved in the first film has apparently stopped the Sky People from coming back, because there's no victory in the prior film. I disagree with that. I think that, because again, like, if you're the humans, well, you just never come back to Pandora because of this big skirmish. Like, isn't this a significant investment for the humans? Would they not return? You know, he says there's no victory. I was 14 years of peace, 14 years of kind of an idyllic existence for Jake and Neytiri and their children. The Sky People come back. Like, yeah, they come back like a decade and a half later. I think that that's an achievement. You go from, you know, possibly facing genocide to, hey, we won and they're gone. Now they come back, but that doesn't mean there's no achievement. There's no victory in the first film. That still means something. And of course the Sky People are going to come back. It's a significant investment for them to mine the resources of these moons. Like, they're not just going to go, well, shit, the native population does not want us there. I guess we'll just take our trillions of dollars and all the spaceships and mining equipment that we flew into deep space, and all the personnel we cryogenically froze and transported to deep space. I guess we'll just go home and we'll just let the Earth die, or we won't make money. Yeah, I don't see that happening. I don't have a problem with all this. I don't have a problem with this at all. The first film is about Jake's transformation and his love story with Neytiri and his self-actualization. So it is the first film is not rendered unnecessary by this. Like, there's still character growth. Jake goes from just kind of this cocky jackass to a leader with somebody who wants something, and somebody who wants to be somebody, and finds himself through this, you know, this conflict. And so I think this film continues this growth now, not as a cocky daredevil, but as a father and a leader with an immense responsibility. It's the adult coming of age. This is what Dustin and I always talk about. Like, can the characters be adults? Well, this is finally a film where the main character is an adult, and it has to face adult problems. And so why aren't we glad to see this? Because I was. Dustin said that he felt like Jake wasn't the protagonist. It was his son's story. It takes too long to latch on to his son. I think this is fully Jake's story, and we're just now becoming introduced to a larger set of characters and an ensemble. And they are indeed characters with depth and distinction. The original discussion with them had me thinking that these characters were just a bunch of Gen Z yahoos, but these, and they are, they're not like super densely written, but I liked these characters. I liked these kids. I thought they were, I don't know. I thought they were interesting. I thought they were fun. There's a difference between, and maybe this is just me making excuses for the film. Maybe it's not. If you're not going to have a super groundbreaking narrative or super groundbreaking story or super groundbreaking approach to your film, like, this isn't Memento. So, you know, the screenplay for Memento and the filmmaking for Memento, Memento is an amazing film for all the reasons that Avatar is not. They're completely different. And one is an inventive, creative, amazing new approach to filmmaking. And the other is a stock mythic hero's journey continuation, that made $2.5 billion for a giant company. but I reject that there isn't story here. James Cameron certainly understands story. Now, James Cameron is not interested or pursuant of complex inventive story. James Cameron, you can say James Cameron's a bad writer. You can say this script is hacky. You can say that whatever, that this is stock. Another way to say that, some people would call that he likes clearly defined characters. He likes characters that are easy to follow with clearly defined goals and distinct personalities. I think that's especially important when you have a film that's populated by a bunch of blue people whose, as I said, whose character models prevent them from having super distinct features from each other. And so I think that that's just a difference of opinion there. I think that you can either say, well, this is stock, or you can say it's just clear definitions. I prefer, especially with James Cameron, who I know is not a hack, who I know is not uninterested in characters or story because of the way he talks about working with actors. One of the reasons he says he loves working in the volume so much and working on the Avatar films is because he doesn't have to worry about all the technical aspects of film while he's shooting. Like he does, but like he can sort of now compartmentalize the things he enjoys about film. He can do all the tech stuff, but when he's on set, he can just work with the actors and he can work much more closely with the actors. And that's something I wasn't aware of him enjoying as much. Some, you know, like George Lucas is not good with actors. George Lucas is not interested in working with actors. He's all about technical shit, and visual effects and shit like that. Every director has their strengths. I wasn't aware that James Cameron was as interested and attuned at working with actors as he has now professed himself to be. And that's why he's such an apologist for this technology for a million reasons, but one of them being he loves actors. All that to say that the story here, is it simple? Yes, it's simple. Are there predictable characters, predictable plot points, predictable scenes? Yes. You're not going to be surprised really with many of the scenes in this movie. Kellen's right. Like there's, you know, that's a fair criticism. It doesn't bother me. I know I'm going to see things and story beats that I'm familiar with, but I'm going to see them in a different way. I'm not just watching another sports movie that does the sports thing. Oh, and now he, or the romantic comedy. Oh, now he gets the misunderstood in bed with the best friend thing. And now they're going to break up and come back together. You know, like it's not like that. Like we're seeing something on screen that's still unique and with characters and a plot that just, I don't know, feels, I don't want to say fresh because Avatar is not necessarily a fresh thing, but I don't want to dismiss it as, yeah, it's a familiar story. Like, okay, well that argument can be extended to a ton of films, including the first one, obviously. I mean, I think that this vastly improves on the first film in terms of the emotional stakes in the character. I mean, once again, like obviously the stake is the planet and the society in the first film and, you know, Jake's life, but now we have his children. And I just thought that that was a much more intimate set of stakes for Jake without losing the threat of, yes, they're going to kill your kids, but they're also going to kill all these other people that now you've put in danger. And so, I don't know, you still feel for Jake, and you still feel the threat on the same scale as you felt in the original film, I think. So there's that. So I'm fully invested in Jake's situation, his fears, his solutions, his lesson that he can't protect his children forever. He can only prepare them for the obstacles of the world into which they're born. I thought that that was a good lesson. I thought that that was entertainingly and also true to the emotional human experience of what that is like. And maybe it's just me being a dad. Maybe it's just me having all these kids. I don't know, but I was very keyed in on his having to come to understand that he cannot always be there or protect his kids, especially when they're his kids, when they are just like him. He can't blame his kids for sharing the very same traits that make him who he is, which is something that all parents go through. Every time my kids do something annoying or reckless or whatever, I sit there and think, like, why are you mad at them? This is exactly how you were, you know? And so I just think that's true to being a parent, but also, like, those things you either have to recognize as flaws in yourself, or you need to recognize that they are strengths. They're inconvenient right now, but they are strengths. And you need to nurture those gifts in your kids so that they can take those gifts into the world and do something good with them, like you hopefully have done. Jake's kids are capable and brave and good-hearted and sometimes a little headstrong, overly loyal, overly protective. All the things that he was in the first film and now does not want them to be, because he recognizes how reckless that is and how much danger they put themselves in by behaving this way, because he's forced to reconcile that very same behavior was reckless when he did it. That's what parenthood is. It's all about recontextualizing behavior that you yourself displayed, but now you're seeing it as this person who has to live with the consequences of that. Like, you know, if my kids jump off something too high and, you know, bang their head on the ground and get a concussion, or, you know, even worse, like hurt themselves much more seriously, I blame myself because I didn't stop it, or I wasn't there to protect them, or I didn't shut it down earlier. I'm supposed to protect these kids. And that fear and that anxiety extends so far into life to the point where a lot of parents get super protective. They don't let their kids do anything. Because they are afraid of seeing them suffer. They're afraid of seeing an injury become a permanent injury, or they're terrified of an accident disabling their children. Just of preventable injuries. And I just thought this was there's plenty of films that explore this. Even Paddington, to an extent, is about this. You know, Mr. Brown is really protective of his son after his son, you know, breaks his arm or his leg or something. Now he doesn't let him do anything fun. He's denying the kid his very nature instead of getting down there alongside him and showing him, well, here's how you balance yourself. You know, like, you wouldn't have fallen if you'd balanced yourself like this, you know. Instead of leaning into those gifts and leaning into those talents and trying to equip your children for the challenges in the world ahead of them, you try to shelter them, and that's a losing battle. And that's what Jake is doing in this film. And they literally live in the woods. They literally live in, like, a tribe. Like, your kids ride whales and they ride these dragons and they hunt and they can fire weapons. They do all this stuff. But you still go, like, hey, what are you doing? Get out of harm's way. What were you doing? What were you thinking? You know, treating them like soldiers, because that's the only way he knows how to transfer authority, instead of being there for them and being their heart or whatever. Anyways, I'm getting all overly whatever about it. But I guess what I'm saying is, I really liked that this film explored that. And I thought it did it very well. I thought that it was honest. I thought that it was true to the human character. And I appreciated that was in a big blockbuster film, and that it was so well acted and written and performed by everybody. I'm excited for the films to come. I'm hopeful that we can explore some of the fallout of trauma, because there's a lot that happens in this movie that would have very traumatic after effects. It wouldn't surprise me if the third film completely glosses over that in the name of plot convenience or, you know, whatever. But I hope it doesn't. I hope that carries over, because characters do things in this film that that are kind of fucked up, and they experience things that are really fucked up. And I want that continued. I want that explored. I don't want that just sort of swept under the rug. You know, what certain losses do to a marriage. I think that that would be something to explore. You know, it'd be nice to have a movie where Jake and Neytiri are not completely on each other's side, because that would be a mature adult story dynamic to explore, especially after what happens in this film. You know, how do you navigate a hit to the family like you have in this movie? How does that affect a marriage? How does that affect trust? How does that affect resentment and blame? And what happens to a couple who are going through that when something truly threatening is happening, like, you know, evil Marines destroying your planet? So there's that. Then again, I never expected that they'd kill a child in an Avatar film. So maybe we'll get there. I know that James Cameron is interested in exploring the other biomes on Pandora. I just don't know how the story will take us there, but I'm interested. But if he's going to make, you know, the next one's going to be like in a desert or something, you know, it's weird. Like, you know, with the first Avatar, it was just, oh, you know, here's, you know, Avatar, whatever. Now this one came out around the same time as Black Panther: Wakanda Forever. And everyone was like, oh, there's two movies about water, you know, and this one's going to come out, I guess, what, next year? The third one's going to come out in 2024. And if it's on a desert, people are going to be like comparing it to Dune. Like, oh, it's this Dune, because Dune Part 2 is going to be out around the same time, I guess. So I don't know. But I'm interested. I want to see more. I am more bought into this series now than I was with the first film. I thought this was way better than the first film. And I would watch it again, gladly. Those are my thoughts. I hope you check it out. It's on Disney Plus, and yeah, see it. Give it a shot. I liked it. I liked it a lot. There, I said it.